welcome to the Mariner's Library with me, Chris Tamwell-Major. In this episode, we're continuing the book The Venturesome Voyages of Captain Voss. We're on the second story, 40,000 Miles Around the World. We're on Chapter 7, and this is the eighth part of the reading. And if you haven't already, please consider going over to patreon.com/themariner, and there for $5 a month, you can help support this podcast and keep the information contained within these fantastic books easily available for the next generation. Now on with the story. Chapter 7, Manahiki. It was a beautiful, clear morning with a moderate breeze from the east-southeast, and in a little while we sailed through the channel near the western village into the Pacific Ocean, after which we changed our course for the island of Manahiki, or as it is called in English, Humphrey Island, distant about 200 miles. The wind freshened as we got away from the land, and a short time before the island dropped out of sight, a heavy squall struck the Tillicum, which forced us to take in all sail, but it only lasted a few minutes, after which the weather cleared up and the wind moderated again. We then set all our sails, and with a fresh breeze reeled off the miles in fine style, and the following night, at 9 o'clock, we sighted the island of Manahiki. The wind, keeping fresh from the east-southeast, we soon closed in with the coast. At 11 o'clock, we rounded the northwest point of the island, and as all villages of the small South Sea Islands that have no harbour are on the west side, which is the lee side of the easterly trade wind that blows nearly all the year round, we commenced to look for the village, which should be, according to the directions given me by Captain Dexter, on the west side, just after rounding the northwest point. Sure enough, after rounding that point, we saw lights on the shore. But as I was also told by Captain Dexter that the safest anchorage was at the other village, which was 4 miles further along, Manahiki has two villages, we followed the coast. It was a fine, clear night, and being on the lee side of the island, the wind was light and the sea smooth. We had nearly reached the first village when we heard all kinds of shouting and noise coming from its direction. I was about to change our course for the open ocean again, when we were surrounded by several canoes full of natives shouting at us to stop. In a second, we had all our firearms up and were ready for action, at the same time keeping the Tillicum on her westerly course. But as the wind was rather light, they could paddle faster than we were sailing, and in a very short time, one of the canoes was alongside of us, in which one of the natives spoke a little English, saying, "Captain, me chief, me speak you." "What do you want?" I demanded. "Stop, me want speak." With that, I let the Tillicum come up to the wind and stopped her headway, allowing the canoe to come alongside. Without any invitation, the man who called himself the chief came on board and offered to shake hands, saying, "Me, chief." The old man told us in very broken English, but plainly enough for us to understand, that the Torch had called there on the way from Penryn and had told them all about us, and since that time they had been watching for us night and day, and as we had arrived now, they wanted us to stop. However, we had made up our minds to go to the other village, so we told the old chief that we would come and see him and his people before we sailed from the island for the west, after which they left us, and a little after midnight we anchored at the western village, where we had another reception somewhat similar to the one we had previously experienced, but no one came on board. At sunrise the next morning, a canoe came alongside us with three men in her. One of them, speaking good English, introduced himself as Mr. Williams, the trader of the island. Mr. Williams then introduced one of the other men in the canoe as the King of the Island. I asked His Royal Highness, who was barefooted and without a hat, to come on board with Mr. Williams, and after I had given the gentleman a short explanation of our doings, the King invited us on shore. At 11 o'clock, we both went on shore and were received by the King and Queen and two fine-looking young princesses, but as neither could speak a word of English, they had the trader, Mr. Williams, there as an interpreter, who, on behalf of the royal family, asked us to accompany the party to the town hall. On arriving at the building, which was only 100 yards from where we had landed, I saw a long table covered with all kinds of eatables. Mr. Williams informed us that the table was set for us, and asked us to sit down and help ourselves. Both of us were seated on a wooden bench behind the table. The royal family sat at one end of the table, to our right, and Mr. Williams also sat there to do the interpreting. After this, all the natives of the village, men, women and children, came in. It took quite a time for the hall to fill, and during the interval, I took an observation of our surroundings. The hall, or rather building, in which this gathering took place, was about 30 feet wide by about 70 feet long, built of rough lumber, and roofed with dry coconut leaves. The table was spread just for the two of us. One roasted pig, weighing about 150 pounds, was placed on the middle of the table, and at either side were flying fish, about half a dozen roasted chickens and yams, arrowroot, taro, coconuts and other made-up dishes. Comparatively speaking, there was enough there for 100 people to make a good square meal. When all the natives had arrived and were seated, the king rose and made a speech to them about our voyage, after which they all clapped their hands. After this discourse, the king whispered to Mr. Williams, and then Mr. Williams told us to help ourselves, and that the king and all his people wished us a pleasant voyage and a safe return to our home. As there were only two places set, we knew very well that they were intended for us, and the pig being too large for us to tackle, we started on the chickens and taro. No sooner had we started eating than the two princesses got up, and one of them placed a fine woven Panama hat, nicely decorated with different coloured ribbons, on my mate's head, and the other princess did the same to me. Mr. Luxton certainly looked queer with his head decorated, and I presume I did also. We stared at each other for a minute, and then my mate said, "These two young girls must be partly gone on us." By that time the two princesses had taken their seats, and two more young ladies came along with more hats of the same description, took off the ones we had, and replaced them with theirs. Immediately after, two more young ladies came along and repeated the performance. That was as much as my mate could stand. He got up and said, "Mr. Williams, will you please tell these young ladies for me that the next one that comes along and changes my hat is going to be kissed?" Of course, the word was sent along by Mr. Williams, after which they all started to laugh and chat about something. I told my mate that he had put his foot in it. The next thing we saw, the oldest woman of the lot, she must have been about 100 years of age, for she was all doubled up and could hardly walk, came along with a straw hat, and as she got nearer Mr. Luxton, he turned pale. I said, "Courage, Norman, courage, don't go back on your word," but I am sorry to say that my mate did on that occasion. However, the young ladies and hats continued arriving, and by the time we got through our feast, he had quite a few hats. Later in the afternoon, we were taken to the king's palace, where we dined with the royal family. The dinner was something similar to what we had had in the hall. The king's residence was built on the same principle as the hall, only smaller. The furniture consisted of two double sleeping places, which were made of 1-inch boards covered with mats and raised about a foot above the ground, one table and two wooden benches. Apparently, the king of Manahiki didn't care very much for ceremony. Dinner over, the royal family accompanied us to the beach where our boat was anchored. We found, to our great surprise, that our little vessel was decorated with long ribbons of various colours hanging from the tops of the masts down to the deck and the water, and the decks were covered with fancy mats. The decorating had been done by the same young ladies who had presented us with the fancy hats. Some of them were still on board the Tilikum, and others were alongside her in their canoes. When we got on board, we found that all the hats, chickens, pig, and everything that we had left on the table had been carefully wrapped up in green leaves and put in our cabin, which was so full that we could not get in it ourselves. I told the trader to thank the natives on our behalf for all their kindness, but that it would be impossible for us to keep everything that they had given us on board. In the first place, we had no room for it, and in the second place, the meat would spoil in a day or two. But the trader, Mr. Williams, informed us that all the natives would take it as an insult if we asked them to take it back, and advised us to keep it and throw it overboard during the night, which, to my sorrow, we were obliged to do. The following morning, I woke to the sound of drums and bells, and on looking out of the cabin saw Mr. Williams standing near the beach. Asking him what was the matter, he informed me that the sound of drums and bells was to call the natives to get ready for a dance, and at the same time asking us to come ashore by 7 o'clock. On landing, we found the natives all gathered round the town hall, about 7 or 8 of them playing different homemade instruments. They were playing a native tune, and about 12 young ladies, ranging in age from 17 to 20, lined up in a double row and danced to the music. The king's two daughters also took part in the dancing. The lady dancers kept it up for quite a while, after which their places were taken by 12 young men. After the men had finished, their places were taken by young girls from 10 to 16 years of age, and so they kept changing about. Children of 7 years and upwards could certainly dance wonderfully. Sometimes men and women danced together. It was continued the whole day, and when they got hungry or thirsty, some of the young men would climb coconut trees and get some green, sweet coconuts and eat the husk, the soft and sweet-tasting kernels, and drink the nice, cool milk. The dancing was kept up till dark, after which they retired into their singing hall, where the men squatted down at one end and the women at the other end of the hall facing each other, with the bandmaster standing in the middle. And it was certainly some of the sweetest music that I ever listened to. This was kept up till after midnight, and then all retired, and we joined our ship. The next day, we took a small boat and sailed through the lagoon to call on the chief and his people as promised. Arriving at the village, we were met by the same old chief we had seen in his canoe when making the land. The old man could speak a little English, though not enough to make himself plainly understood, but there was also a trader there who spoke English. He asked this man to tell us that he would be very much obliged if we would come again in our own boat, when they would receive us just as well as the king and his people had done. As the people at the other village had treated us so well, and on finding out that this chief and his people had been watching for us for many nights past to get us to anchor at their village so that they could be the first to give a reception, we agreed to do as the chief asked. We thereupon returned to the village from whence we had come, and in company of the two princesses, sailed for the old chief's village next morning at about 7 o'clock, arriving there an hour later. We could see the natives, young and old, lined up along the beach, and when within about 200 yards of the shore, the old chief jumped into the water and swam towards us, and by the time we had our anchor down, he was on board the canoe to welcome us to his town. We then went ashore, and I had just about as good a time as we had had in the other village. Just before dark, we returned to the western village as we had promised the king and queen to bring their daughters back that night. When we got there, both of us felt inclined to give up the cruise and make this place our home for the remainder of our lives. The island of Manahiki is, like Penryn, a coral lagoon island, but is not quite so large, as the lagoon is only 5 miles in diameter, and there is no entrance, not even for small boats. The ring of land, which is also covered with coconut trees, seems to be wider than that of Penryn. The natives of Manahiki look like the Penryn people, but are much more pleasant and are lovers of sport. Chapter 8. Danger Island and Samoa. On the morning of September the 25th, after saying goodbye to all the natives on shore, including the two young princesses, we went on board to take our departure. A good many of the natives came in their canoes to see us off. In trying to get our anchor up, we found that it had got foul of the bottom, and we were therefore unable to move it. The native bandmaster, who was one of those who had come to see us off, went ashore in his canoe, and within a minute or two was back with a water telescope, with which he went overboard, and by swimming around for a little while and surveying the bottom through the telescope, he soon located the anchor. He then pushed the telescope aside, and down he went. He came up with the Tilikum's largest anchor in his hand, swam alongside and passed it on board. I offered to pay for his service, but it was not accepted. We thanked him, and once more saying goodbye to the people who came on board to see us off, they re-entered their canoes and we set sail and shaped our course for Danger Island, distant about 300 miles. The weather was clear, and the wind moderate from the east-southeast, but as we got away from the lee of the island, it increased to a fresh breeze, and by noon the island was out of sight. While I was steering, I asked my mate to open the parcel that the two princesses had brought on board just before we sailed, which he did, and found two roasted chickens in it. Needless to say, we had roast chicken for lunch. The 300 miles to Danger Island, owing to a rather mild trade wind, took us 3 days to cover, during which time we had fine weather, and nothing unusual happened with the exception of our catching quite a few flying fish at night. This was done by putting a bright light on deck, to which they will fly and very often strike the sail and fall on deck. The flying fish is one of the best eating fish to be found in salt water, so we made good use of them. September 25th, a little before dark, we sighted the island, but dreading the name Danger on the chart, we hove to for the night, and the next morning at daybreak set sail and steered in for it. As we got near the island, we could see three small and apparently separated islands, which we ascertained were connected and surrounded by low coral reefs, on which the sea was breaking heavily. We kept the island, reefs and breakers on our port side, and with a fresh breeze, followed the breakers round till we got to the westernmost island. At Danger Island, as there is no lagoon or harbour for a vessel to go in, the villages are on the west side. When we arrived at a favourable position, we shaped our course for a village we espied among the coconut trees, and as we neared the land, I took soundings for an anchorage, but found deep water right up to the beach. A good many natives came running towards us, and one of them, who spoke a little English, told us that the water was too deep to anchor, but by putting our anchor on the beach, the wind would keep the boat from swinging onto the shore. With that, we did as the natives advised, and apparently the Tilikum laid there quite safely. This native then introduced himself as the chief of Danger Island, and invited us to come on shore to the village. Not caring to leave the Tilikum at such a poor anchorage, I declined the invitation. It was then about 2 o'clock, and owing to the dangerous sailing round Danger Island, I told the chief that we wished to get underway again so as to be clear of the surrounding reefs before dark. The chief did not seem to like this, but seeing that we would not stay, asked us to remain for 1 hour, which we agreed to do. He at once sent 2 of his men to the village, and in about an hour they came back loaded with coconuts and eggs. We thanked him and took our departure, and rounding a long coral reef running quite a way into the northwestward, shaped our course for Samoa, about 400 miles away, which we made in 3 days, experiencing similar wind and weather as we had all the way from Penrhyn Island. On nearing the harbour, we saw flags flying at half-mast all over the town, and the first news we got was that President McKinley of the United States had been assassinated about a week previously, but Samoa had only received the sad news that very morning. Apia was the first port which we were obliged to enter and clear in the same manner as any other deep-water vessel. But Mr. Reinhardt, the collector of customs, after coming on board and noting the size and build of our vessel, saying with a smile that he would not cross a millpond in the Tilikum, freed us of all harbour dues. We remained several days in Apia, during which time we made the acquaintance of the ex-king of Samoa, and some of the leading citizens honoured us with a Samoan dinner, of which the serving of kava was the most interesting part. A root of which the kava is made was brought in, cut to pieces and given to 3 Samoan beauties, and after my mate had examined their teeth and reported them as clean and polished, all 3 sat on a clean mat round a kava bowl and chewed the root into a juicy mass. When sufficient root had been prepared, it was put in the kava bowl, half filled with water, in which it was washed and squeezed with the hands until every drop of the juice was extracted and mixed with water. After straining it through a clean linen cloth, it appeared of a whitish colour. It was then served in coconut shell, and to me the taste was anything but pleasant. Still, as a matter of courtesy, I, like the rest, drank to the dregs without a pause. The cups were at once refilled, and the ceremony repeated several times, so that by the time we were ready to return, I felt somewhat weak in the knees, and in a little while I got so shaky in the legs that I was quite unable to walk. I then discovered that kava is an intoxicating drink, but that instead of going to a man's head like other strong spirits, it mainly affects his lower extremities. The Samoan Islands, the natives and their habits have been so often described that I omit that part and proceed with my voyage. Well, that's all for today. I hope you're enjoying the story so far. The next instalment will be available in the Mariner's Library shortly. And remember, of course, you've got all the content over on YouTube and the Mariner podcast, and of course, Patreon at patreon.com/themariner. But for now, wherever you are and whatever you're doing, I hope that you're safe and sound, and I look forward to speaking to you in the next one. Cheers.